If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
KQED. 10 o'clock now.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, child farm workers. Children as young as 12 can work legally in California's agriculture industry, but they describe unsafe and unsanitary conditions and a fear of speaking up because they cannot afford to lose their jobs. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Robert J. Lopez spoke with more than 60 children who work in the fields in Salinas, Santa Maria, San Joaquin, and Pajaro Valleys. We'll talk to Lopez about the state's lack of regulatory oversight and how it's been responding to Lopez's reporting. Join us after this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump is attacking Europe again, calling America's allies weak and decaying. NPR's Mara Liasson has details.
In a wide-ranging interview with Politico, Trump denigrated the Western European democracies that until now have been the United States' staunchest allies. Trump said Europe doesn't know what to do. He blamed European leaders for failing to control immigration or stopping the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
They have to play ball. If they don't read agreements, potential agreements, you know, it's not easy with Russia because Russia has the upper hand.
Trump is pushing Ukraine's president, Vladimir Zelensky, to accept his latest peace plan, which includes several core Russian demands. It would force Ukraine to give up territory to Russia, put limits on Ukraine's military, and restrict the country's sovereignty. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
A federal judge has agreed to release grand jury and other investigative materials from the prosecution of Ghislaine Maxwell, a longtime confidant of the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR's Ryan Lucas has the latest.
The Justice Department in November asked a federal judge in New York to release the investigative materials from Ghislaine Maxwell's sex trafficking case after Congress passed the Epstein Files Transparency Act. Now, U.S. District Court Judge Paul Engelmayer has granted that request and authorized the department to publicly release the grand jury materials as well as the investigative records while redacting personally identifiable or other victim-related information. A similar request to make public investigative records from Epstein's prosecution in New York is still pending before a different federal judge. Maxwell is currently serving a 20-year prison sentence for sex trafficking and other offenses. Epstein died in a federal lockup in 2019. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. Supreme Court is weighing a Trump-backed appeal to end limits on party spending in federal elections. The justices are revisiting a 2001 decision that upheld a provision of federal election law that dates back more than half a century. High courts also considering the administration's challenge to a 90-year-old decision limiting presidential control over independent agencies. Policymakers from the Fed are holding a two-day meeting in Washington, D.C., NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Investors are fairly confident the central bank will lower its benchmark interest rate by a quarter percentage point tomorrow. They'll also be watching what Fed Chairman Jerome Powell and his colleagues have to say about prospects for additional rate cuts in the new year. There's considerable uncertainty as the central bank's trying to keep a lid on both inflation and unemployment. Pepsi is planning to cut jobs and narrow its product lineup by 20% as it works to cut costs and lower prices. The soft drink and snack maker has been under pressure from an activist investor. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Paul Lancour. A South Bay high school is investigating after a group of students formed a human swastika on its football field. KQED's Jalar Zeta has more.
San Jose's Branham High School says it received a, quote, disturbing tip about the social media post. The photo, which was reportedly removed 2 days after it went live, showed a group of students forming a, quote, human swastika with their bodies on the football field and was captioned with an anti-Semitic quote by Adolf Hitler. In a statement, school principal Beth Silbergeld called the incident a, quote, unacceptable act of anti-Semitism, and said the students identified in the photo are, quote, committed to taking accountability for the harm that was done. She said that the incident was reported to San Jose police. I'm Joel Arzeda, KQED News.
Attorney General Rob Bonta says his office stands ready to assist San Jose officials as they investigate the anti-Semitic incident at Branham High. Bonta says his office will step in to help if asked by local police and school officials.
There's no room for hate in California, no matter who you are, where you're from, who you love, how you pray. You belong here, and you deserve to be safe and be able to thrive free of hate.
The attorney general noted that in addition to prosecuting hate crimes, his office compiles a report every year examining the data around such crimes. That information, Bonta says, helps shape policies aimed at countering hate. I'm Paul Lancour, KQED News.
Morning support comes from San Francisco Bay University, offering degree programs in tech and business for a world shaped by AI. sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And the listeners and members of KQED. For the Bay, areas of clouds and fog and some sun mixed together heading into the midday, becoming partly to mostly sunny later. Highs in the 50s to the 60s. Today, heads up, beach hazard statement issues gets issued tomorrow morning. Watch out for high surf and sneaker waves. That's in effect Wednesday through Friday evening.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Picking strawberries, apples, cabbages, or kale in California's fields and orchards is hard work, sometimes punishing and dangerous when the weather and heat are bad, with heavy loads to lift and quotas to meet. And yet children are doing this work alongside adults. California allows kids as young as 12 to work in agriculture. But according to an investigation by Capital and Maine in partnership with the Los Angeles Times, the state is failing to ensure the children's health and safety. We learn more this hour with Robert J. Lopez, Pulitzer Prize-winning independent journalist and fellow at the McGraw Center for Business Journalism. Robert, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Erica Diaz-Cervantes, a former underage farm worker, now senior policy advocate at Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy, or CAUSE. Erica, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. So Robert, how many kids do you estimate work as farm workers in California's fields? And I say estimate, right, for a reason.
Yes, it is an estimate because there is really no tracking that's done comprehensively by government agencies. The work is very transitory. So it's very hard to sort of know exactly how many young people are out there, but certainly several thousand in California and, you know, elsewhere across the nation. There's others, but I focus solely on California. And that's really about the best estimate that we came up with in my talks with experts examining the various studies that have been done by the federal government, surveys, things like that. So I think that's a fair estimate.
And are most of these young people, are they migrants, U.S. born? What can you tell us?
Well, nearly all the young people I spoke to were born in the United States. Their parents immigrated primarily from Mexico. And these are mixed status families. By that, I mean the children are born here and citizens, and many of the parents are not documented, but also work alongside their sons and daughters in the fields.
Doing what kind of work exactly?
It varies. They pick strawberries, as you said. They plant broccoli, plant lettuce, pick broccoli, pick lettuce, pick blueberries. They work in orchards with citrus fruit, stone fruit. They may harvest garlic in the San Joaquin Valley. There's various jobs. And when there's not planting or picking, they try and get any other work they can get, such as pulling weeds from fields, removing old plastic tarps. Farm working is not a 40-hour work, a week work job. It's seasonal and dependent on many factors. So families need to survive, and they'll do whatever work they can get when it's available.
And why is it that California allows children as young as 12 to work in agriculture like this when, you know, child laborers and other industries are usually required to be 14 or older?
In most instances, California requires minors to be 14 years old to work. But in agriculture, as you know, a child can be as young as 12 years old and work up to 40 hours a week when school is not in session. And the reason is really a complex reason that really lies in federal law, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was passed in the late 1930s, initially didn't include farm workers. Farm workers were only included years later in the 1960s. So it's really rooted in federal law and goes back, several generations. And in some states, there is no minimum age. California actually has some of the strongest workplace safety laws in the United States, including outdoor heat laws, child labor regulations, pesticide safety laws. But as I found out in my investigation, many of these are not being enforced.
Yes, you would think if the state allows such young workers, the expectation would be that they'd be vigilant about enforcing child labor laws, since kids are more vulnerable in workplaces generally, power-wise, and then more sensitive to conditions in the fields, Robert?
You would think so, but it's very difficult when, for example, the Bureau of Field Enforcement, this is a state agency that is the frontline unit for enforcing not only child labor laws, but wage and hour laws. So when you have 54 inspectors, which is what their data showed as of May, responsible for covering the entire state of California, and not just agriculture, but more than a half dozen industries, including car washes, hotels, retail establishments, warehouses. I mean, you just don't have enough people to create a physical presence. And many of the researchers I talked to at UC Merced and elsewhere who have sort of studied enforcement actions in labor, you know, note that when you're out there and you're giving citations and you're inspecting work sites, there's a deterrent effect. And people know that inspectors may show up, but when there's no presence at all, then none of that happens.
Erica, I want to turn to you because you started working in the fields when you were 12. What was it like for you? What do you remember about starting?
Yeah, thank you. I, like you mentioned, I started working in the fields with my parents when I was as young as 12 years old. I remember working with my mom. We worked picking green beans. That was our first job. And it wasn't just myself. It was my brother, who was 11 at the time, and my older sister, who was 14. And so it was the three of us working alongside my mom. And what I remember from that summer is just that it was extremely hot. We were covered in multiple layers of clothing to protect us from the exposure of toxic chemicals as well as like heat exposure. I just remember feeling this pressure to fill up our buckets with green beans as quickly as we could and get it to load in the truck and making sure that our cards were stamped so they were marking the amount of buckets we were filling up. In that same job, we also picked green tomatoes, and I remember those buckets being extremely heavy. I often tried to carry it myself down these really rugged dirt pathways, but it was a really big struggle. So oftentimes it was my brother and I carrying about a 30-pound bucket of tomatoes and trying to pick as quickly as we could to try to make enough money for that day.
Yeah, pick as quickly as you can. Because what was the culture of these workplaces? What were the expectations? How did you feel like you were treated?
Yeah, I just remember feeling really intimidated by the supervisors, by the crew leaders. There was constant pressure to continue working as quickly as you can. Anytime we tried to take any breaks or even go get some water, it was really discouraged, and we were even reprimanded for doing so because we were wasting productivity time. A lot of times my mom would try to you know, try to help us in terms of being able to match the pace as the rest of the crew, so we weren't falling behind. And I just remember feeling really scared every time we saw the supervisor's truck that would come and inspect the fields. Every time he would walk around the crew and just watch how we were picking the crops, I just felt a really deep sense of fear of I need to pick as fast as I can. And even though my back was hurting, like my knees were hurting, and I felt really exhausted already by, you know, 11 a.m., the heat was already starting to pick up. I felt like I couldn't rest at all because I was just scared of, you know, the punishment that we would get if we didn't continue to pick really quickly.
And you were paid per, like, box or per bucket, am I right?
Yeah. So for the buckets, I don't recall how much they were paying us at the time, but I remember it wasn't a lot. I remember that we had to pick multiple buckets and boxes to be able to earn enough and support my family. And I just remember at the time thinking, you know, I need to work really hard and work really fast and make sure that you know, no attention is being drawn to us in the sense of like negative attention, just because there was this really strong power dynamic between us, being the farm workers working in the fields and the supervisors and the employers that were managing other workplaces.
Yeah. Robert, in terms of the things that Erica is describing, well, first of all, how much are the kids you're talking to today being paid? And does it meet California's laws around minimum wage, for example?
Well, first of all, most of the youths I spoke to who work for Peace Rate, which is by the unit, as Erica described, shared similar stories, intimidation, you know, worried that if they don't work fast enough, they're going to get their parents fired and them fired. And in fact, that did happen with one young man I interviewed. So they told the same types of stories time and again. And the rates vary depending on a lot of factors, the season, the time of year, how much fruit there is in a field. But in some cases, young workers were getting paid $2.40 a box.
$2 and 40 cents?
For a box of strawberries. And when I say a box, it's a cardboard box that holds 8 of those cartons that you buy in a supermarket, you know, for anywhere from, you know, $5 to $7 a carton. So 8 of those. So they're getting $2.40. And in some cases, that's all they got. And the issue is if you're an adult, strong, and you can work fast and you're experienced and a veteran, you can pick a lot of boxes. But young people are not as strong. They don't work as fast, just as Erica described with her own experience. So as a result, there would be times when they didn't fill many boxes. And so at the end of the day, they wouldn't earn the equivalent of minimum wage, which would be a violation of state child labor and labor laws. Because under state law, Peace Rate workers, regardless of the industry, have to earn the equivalent of at least minimum wage. So when that doesn't happen, that's a violation of state law. And I heard countless stories from young people, not just in the fields, but also in orchards, filling 500-pound crates with grapefruit, lemons, oranges. I heard countless stories in which they were talking about earning wages that did not equal minimum wage. So this is something that I heard from the very beginning, when I first started doing my interviews, really throughout.
We're talking about child farm workers in California and shining a spotlight on the issues they face. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for KQED comes from Marin Country Mart at Larkspur Landing, an authentic 1970s village with more than 40 independent shops, a dozen eateries and local services such as a toy store, bookstore, and barbershop. More at marincountrymart.com. And Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. Ahead at 11.
I'm Robin Young. Could you make it through 48 hours without using AI? Reporter AJ Jacobs tried and found AI everywhere. For instance, his city tracks water usage.
If I'm taking it really seriously, which I did, then I can't turn on the water. I can't drink water. I can't wear clothes made in the last 20 years.
So he wore his grandfather's clothes. Oh boy. Next time, Here and Now. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about child work farm workers in California this hour because children as young as 12 can work legally in California's agriculture industry. But as Robert J. Lopez found, they are working in often harsh conditions with a fear of speaking up about issues or violations and in the face of a lack of regulatory oversight for any violations of child farm labor. Robert J. Lopez is a journalist, an independent journalist, and his reporting can be found in Capital and Maine in partnership with the Los Angeles Times, also in the LA Times, with the headlines, California's child farm workers exhausted, underpaid, and toiling in toxic fields, and lacks oversight. Few inspections leave child farm workers exposed to toxic pesticides. Erica Diaz Cervantes is a former underage farm worker, now senior policy advocate at Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy. And you, our listeners, are joining the conversation with your questions and reactions to Robert's reporting. Do you work in agriculture? Are you a farm worker? Have you noticed or experienced things with child labor? How would you like to see the state address child labor issues in ag? You can email forum at kqed.org, find us on Discord, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, or Threads at KQED Forum, or you can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. So, Robert, you were saying that employers are required to pay piece rate laborers at least the equivalent of minimum wage, otherwise it's a violation. But based on your reporting, it doesn't sound like that was a violation that would frequently be brought down, in part also because workers were afraid of complaining, especially minors. What were the actual or most often cited violations by the state? I'm just curious, you know, I know there were a very small number relative to, say, the number of complaints, but when they did come down, what did they come down for?
That's a very good question. Over an eight-year period, there were 27 citations issued by child labor investigators, and nearly every one of these were for failing to have a work permit on file for underage workers. Every minor is required to have a work permit issued by the school district. School districts are required under state law to inform young people of their rights. But none of the young people I spoke to were even aware of work permits or the need for work permits. And that was the most cited violation in nearly every one of these instances.
Which I guess is important, right? Because I understand that some of the children you spoke with said they began working before age 12. Do you want to talk about how young some of the kids were?
The youngest that I spoke to were 12 years old, several. But many of the kids I spoke to started when they were 11. One 15-year-old boy told me he started when he was 9 years old, 6 years old, and a 15-year-old girl told me she started when she was 9. So sometimes they're younger. And the reason it's important to have work permits, because there are hour limits and other limits imposed on workers who are less than 16. You're not supposed to work more than 40 hours a week if you're under 16, and you can't work late at night if you're under 16. But I heard stories of young people under 16 working under the lights, you know, in avocado orchards and elsewhere. So it's really important for employers to, you know, have work permits and know the ages of their workers.
Erica, did you remember supervisors asking about your age or having work permits or knowing your rights?
No, I think that was one of the things that I really reflected on, is that children in the agriculture field was really normal. I remember seeing a lot of kids there with their families as well, and supervisors would come and inspect the fields, but they were rarely inspecting the workers, and especially not giving trainings on our rights or even like the dangers to working in farm labor. I just remember a lot of supervisors would see us there as we were all with our parents and working in the fields, but really would just turn a blind eye to the kids working in the agricultural fields.
So the violation of not having, you know, a work permit on file for the child was one that the state actually did issue, I guess, 27 citations over an 8-year period around. But based on your reporting, Robert, it sounds like that was sort of the tip of the iceberg when it came to violations, in particular around issues related to pesticide exposure. That's a real problem, right? What can you tell us about this from your reporting?
Well, obviously, pesticides are something that affect all farm workers because they're all out there, regardless of their ages. The issue, however, with young people is that their bodies are developing. And so if they're exposed to pesticides, it can have long-term effects on, you know, the neurological system, on the vital organs, according to the research I read and the medical experts I interviewed. The issue here in California is that it's split in terms of enforcement. You have the state regulatory body, the Department of Pesticide Regulation, and you also have agricultural commissioners, 55 of them, who are responsible for boots-on-the-ground enforcement in their counties. And what I found through an analysis of more than 40,000 enforcement records from 2017 to the first quarter of 2024 is that there was really piecemeal enforcement at the local level. For instance, agricultural commissioners, when they issue a citation in their county, are not required by the state to check the statewide compliance history of that business they are about to cite. So what we found, there were more than 200 businesses that had more than 1,200 fines in multiple counties. But for nearly half of those violations, they were never fined. They only received warning notices or, you know, training, or were asked to correct the problems. So you had repeat offenders committing multiple violations in different counties, but not really being fined for that. There was also differences in the way that fines were imposed for the same violations. They were considered serious in one county, not as serious in another. They were fined X amount in one county, Y amount in another. So there was really no consistency in the way that this was being applied at a statewide level.
Yeah. I want to play a clip of a 16-year-old you interviewed, Robert, who worked the Salinas and Pajaro Valleys of Monterey County as a strawberry picker and was regularly exposed to pesticides.
Whenever I was exposed to pesticides, I would get really bad eye irritation. My eyes would burn so badly, and it would continue to burn like hours until I got home. And sometimes I would break out into rashes, especially all over my arms.
Erica, did you also experience or hear about issues related to pesticide exposure?
Yeah, pesticide exposure has been a really dangerous issue that a lot of us have experienced for a long time. I also remember when working in the variety of crops that I worked in, I would often have like my fingers peeling. I remember I would get like a lot of redness in my eyes, and my mom was really adamant about us wearing protective gear. In this case, it was bandanas covering our face, but that could only do so much to protect us from the harmful chemicals. And my mother, a farm worker who had worked, you know, at a very young age as well, and all throughout her pregnancies, had developed a respiratory issue that she still hasn't resolved. And a lot of it, I, you know, tie back to the just consistent exposure from pesticides.
Robert, you say that, you know, people are supposed to be trained on ways to avoid direct exposure to pesticides and even sign documents confirming they received this training and so on. Is that effective?
Well, if it's done properly, yes. The issue is that I spoke to a number of young people, as well as their parents, who were just given a sack of documents and said and told sign them. They didn't really understand what they were signing. They don't recall receiving any type of pesticide training. What they do recall is that the documents had something to do with pesticides. So in those instances, it was clearly not effective in terms of them knowing their rights about pesticides.
Because these were documents that were saying, yes, in fact, I did receive the pesticide training?
Based on what they signed, they believed that that was the case, but they really were not sure. You know,
Yeah.
They were, you know, in one case, the girl said, she told me, well, you know, I was young. I didn't know what to do, but I signed it.
Yeah. Well, Sam on Discord writes, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that 27 citations over 8 years in a state with close to 40 million people is basically the same as no citations whatsoever. I wouldn't be surprised if there were thousands or tens of thousands of citable cases of just work permits alone. Steve on Discord writes, we need the penalty for employing children without work permits and or for violating child labor laws to be severe enough to actually dissuade employers. And Carl writes, Cal, OSHA, and the Contractor State License Board cannot enforce all of the laws. There's too many companies. And when you make a complaint, they say we'll come out there next Tuesday, and by then the issue's gone. You mentioned earlier, related to pesticide violations, local officials. Can you just briefly explain for me the interaction between local enforcers and state enforcers and whether that system is effective or not?
Well, state enforcers are responsible for an oversight of the entire state. And they, have ultimate jurisdiction, you know, when it comes to pesticide laws. But the actual enforcement is done by agricultural commissioners and their staffs in the various counties. And the commissioners, receive guidance and training from the state, and they work with the state. They, however, are appointed by their respective, boards of supervisors. So they actually report to their boards. And they also have a dual role here. They enforce pesticide laws, but they also promote agricultural interests. I mean, that's their job. So there's sort of that dual role that they have. And they would tell me that it is effective because each county varies in terms of, you know, climate, terrain, crops, growing seasons. And so agricultural commissioners describe their jobs as really working specifically for the needs of their counties.
Let me go to caller Michael in Novato. Hi, Michael. Join us. You're on.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thanks for the very important topic, especially the young woman sharing her story and, Robert, your journalistic work. I worked as a teacher with a lot of migrant kids down in San Luis Obispo County in Guadalupe and Napomo, Arroyo Grande. And this is a reality I want people to know. From what I've seen and understood from kids and parents, the mega capitalist agribusiness, big bosses, they don't care about the people or the workers or the youth especially. What can consumers do to battle this corruption, this inhumane treatment of people? Should we buy organic, buy a farmer's markets? What can we avoid and do with our purchase power to kind of fight back? Because clearly the state and the politicians and the capitalists aren't concerned. Thanks very much.
Michael, thanks. What do you think about what Michael's saying, Robert, and what can consumers do?
Well, you certainly can buy organic. The issue with organic, however, is the price. Organic vegetables and produce are typically more expensive than produce that's produced with chemical-based pesticides. And so there's an equity issue there. People who have the ability to afford that, well, they can do that. But the unfortunate reality is that the very people who are picking all of this fruit and all of these vegetables, they're the very ones who can't afford this. So, yes, that's one way to go about it, but it's, not universally applicable to everybody.
Erica, what do you think? What can consumers do?
Yeah, I think, a lot of what comes to mind is just kind of thinking of why these children are put into these conditions in the first place. And as we know, farm labor has so many different dangerous exposures. And when we think about it, it's that a lot of families have to work in agriculture labor because of how low the wages are, that a parent's income alone is not enough to provide for a family. I think a lot of what's been happening, here, especially in the Central Coast, is farm workers have been trying to push for better wages, for better working conditions. They have performed their own wildcat strikes over the past summer since 2020 during the pandemic, when workers were being exposed even more so. A lot of employers were not following, the CDC regulations and the guidelines to protect workers, especially during the pandemic. And it's something that still exists today. I think for something that consumers can do is, you know, not only one, gain consciousness and awareness of where their produce is coming from, especially knowing that behind every piece of fruit, every vegetable and every crop, that there's a family and often a child, whose safety and dignity must matter. Farm workers have already started this initiative in pushing for a living wage, for better conditions. And I think, you know, for everyone who benefits from their labor can definitely do their part in standing in solidarity with them and calling their local representatives to really ensure that we're putting farm workers first, and prioritizing their safe and well-being.
Deb writes, no child should be forced to perform toxic and backbreaking work. Do some farm workers bring their kids for lack of childcare? Are the children forced to work by their parents, Erica?
No. So I think that's something that a lot of folks sometimes think, but the reality is farm worker families are struggling just to have food on the table. Mothers are struggling just to get diapers for their babies. Their wages are so low that it takes a whole family unit to work in the fields. I know from my part, when I was young, my family was often struggling with housing. There was a point where during the winter months, like Robert was mentioning, farm labor is seasonal, and there's only so much that you can put into a savings from the very low wages that you earn. And in the winter, we were living in a van. We couldn't afford to, afford a 1 to 2 bedroom apartment. And, you know, that was years ago when I was 12 years old, and now to the current realities, to the cost of living in 2025, it's impossible for a family to be able to afford a 1-bedroom unit in the own city that they work in. And so I think, you know, for children to work with their parents, it's something that they feel this responsibility in the sense of being able to contribute just so their family can scrape by. And I think this is a situation that the system has set up specifically in agriculture labor, where production and profit is often at the cost of farm worker lives and especially children. Mm-hmm. And so this is all preventable if we're able to create a reality where farm workers are paid a dignified wage, where their children don't have to work just to be able to make ends meet.
Yeah, and given those pressures, Erica, then would it be fair to say that at least in the short term or the current term, it's not that parents would necessarily support, like, banning, the state banning children under the age of 14 from working in the fields?
I think, you know, when we're thinking about it, it's that a lot of farm worker parents don't want their children to work in the fields. They don't want them to be in the dangers of being exposed to, you know, over 90 degree heat or operate dangerous equipment where their fingers can get chopped off. A lot of the conditions in farm labor is extremely dangerous, and a lot of times farm worker families have to make the choice of whether they want a roof over their head or whether they have to work. And I think that shouldn't be a choice that families should be having to make.
We're talking with Erica Diaz-Cervantes of CAUSE and a former child farm worker, and Robert J. Lopez, who has done an investigation about the conditions for California's child farm workers. And we'll have more with them and with you after the break. This is Forum. Coming up tomorrow on Forum, lawmakers are demanding that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth release video of the September strike that killed 2 survivors of a U.S. attack on their boat in the Caribbean. That strike, which the Pentagon says targeted drug traffickers, has prompted war crime accusations. And since then, the U.S. has launched more than 20 strikes in the region, killing more than 80 people. We talk about the impact and legality of the attacks, other controversies at the DOD, and the political implications for Hegseth. Join us. For past Forum shows, go to Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour about reporting that uncovered the state's lack of regulatory oversight of child farm workers who toil in the fields as young as 12 legally, though some may be younger. Robert J. Lopez wrote these pieces, Pulitzer Prize-winning independent journalist and fellow at the McGraw Center for Business Journalism. Erica Diaz-Cervantes is a senior policy advocate at Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy, which serves immigrant communities in California's Central Coast, and a former child farm worker. She worked in the fields from 12 to 20 years old. Listeners, do you work in agriculture? Are you a farm worker? What have you noticed or experienced with child labor? How should the state address child labor issues in ag? What questions or reactions are you having to what Robert and Erica are sharing? The email address is forum@kqed.org. Find us on Discord, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, or Threads at KQED Forum, or call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Robert, when you talked to the families, what did they tell you they would like to see in terms of addressing the types of workplace conditions, toxic violations, several other things, you know, that have been going on? What do they tell you they would like to see, and what do they worry about might come as a consequence of your reporting that they don't want to see?
Well, they would like to see, as Erica said, better wages. At the core, this story is a story about poverty involving some of California's most vulnerable families. So certainly wages was one of the top things that people wanted improved based on my conversations with parents and children who work in the fields and orchards. Number two, safety issues. They'd like to see more vigilance when it comes to enforcing safety laws, worksite safety laws, and pesticide safety laws. The things that they don't want to see are families broken apart if immigration authorities descend on the fields. As I said earlier, many of these families are mixed immigration families. The children were born here, but the parents may be undocumented. Older siblings may not have documentation. So clearly, they're worried about that now more so than ever, given what has transpired here in California and across the nation. And also, too, there's the power differential that Erica talked about earlier, the fear of retaliation from employers. People don't complain because they're fearful. They don't want to lose their jobs. They don't want to be singled out as troublemakers, they tell me. And this is especially true of the children. And all of this creates additional stress on the young people I talk to. They, many of them are constantly worrying. And so that's the reality out there.
We reached out to the governor's office and the State Labor and Workforce Development Agency to join the program, but they sent the following statement instead. Here's just a piece of it. They write, as mentioned in Mr. Lopez's reporting, California has assessed millions of dollars in penalties for child labor violations across all industries. The Department of Industrial Relations is developing a joint outreach and engagement strategy with Cal/OSHA to increase its presence in the fields and its capacity to identify violations. The state continues to build trust and strengthen relationships with workers and community partners through outreach to encourage the reporting of labor violations. In a climate where federal authorities are targeting immigrant communities, California's agricultural workers, who are overwhelmingly immigrant workers, are even more wary of engaging any government entity or reporting violations, making California's worker engagement efforts critical to ensuring workers know they have labor rights. I understand that there has been some response from the state since your reporting. How would you characterize how the state is responding to it, Robert?
Well, they responded within days. I reached out to the governor's office, and they connected me to the officials with the Labor Workforce Agency. And as you noted in the response, they are enhancing coordination among two really important agencies. One is the Bureau of Field Enforcement, which, as I said earlier, regulates child labor and wage and hour laws. And the other is Cal/OSHA, which is responsible for enforcing worksite safety And by that, we're talking about sanitary bathrooms. We're talking about working around dangerous equipment and working in extreme heat. These two agencies typically work individually, enforce different laws, but by joining forces, the state says that they'll be able to pool their resources and have a greater presence in the field and share information to identify potential violations for investigation. So that's a step in the right direction, but there are other long-term issues that really need to be addressed that are far more complex.
Catherine writes, I started working at my dad's grocery store in Corcoran as a child, like he and his siblings did for generations. While stocking produce, it was always clear to me that children younger than me were picking the produce our family sold. Even though I no longer live in Corcoran, my sadness and memories remain. Erica, do you have long-term effects from, you know, your near decade of working in agriculture or things that you noticed in other kids?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I've noticed in terms of my health and along with other, you know, my siblings as well as other folks that we know that have worked at a really young age is having, you know, the physical toll on our bodies, especially at a young age, carrying, you know, heavy boxes, heavy buckets, running at that, the physically demanding labor has resulted in, you know, like really lower back pain. Our hands get really like stiff. And a lot of times, a lot of folks had injuries in the fields where they've either tripped, or they've fallen or they've gotten cut with a machinery or a dangerous tool. And then I think speaking for myself, I think a lot of the things that I'm noticing in what has affected me is not until this age that I am now, 25. But a lot of it I can tie back to when I was younger and, how my body went through an extremely demanding, working environment at a young age.
Yeah. Andy writes, I'm in my 70s and grew up in a rural farm country. I started working on my family farm when I was 5 and worked right up until I left to go to college. My farm responsibility started small but grew as I did. I got up early enough to work for an hour or two before catching the bus to school. When I got home from school, it was my choice to do my farm work first or my homework first, but both had to get done before bedtime. I will be forever grateful for the strong work ethic I learned. I wonder, Erica, if you feel like you have long-term effects that you appreciate about the work that you did?
You know, I think one of the things that I can be appreciative about is that because I experienced those conditions firsthand and I saw the realities of farm labor, and I think, you know, I really appreciate that shared testimony that this person had shared, but I think with farm labor, that power dynamic that existed, yeah, that reprimand, the punishment, this demand for you to work as hard as you can, I think that's something that I still carry with me to this day. And it's led me to do the work that I do today, which is policy advocacy for immigrant workers, specifically farm workers, yeah, is being able to share what those realities are to policymakers, to decision makers. And a lot of what I learned are things that unfortunately are still happening today, as clearly we've been able to see through Robert's article, and it's a cycle that needs to stop. It's something that has been normalized and has been accepted for a long time. Now that eyes are being shown to the issue and this light is being shed on it, it's time for a transformation, and especially time for California to really step up and take the initiative to protect workers and an action that really ends this generational exploitation. And I believe that begins with a dignified wage for farm workers.
Well, Larissa on Discord writes, my thanks to Erica for sharing her story. Farm workers are such a vulnerable community that we keep in the shadows. Thank you all for shedding light on what's happening. RJ writes, I'm ashamed that I've been eating fruits and vegetables my entire life without recognizing my tacit approval of these horrible workplace wages and conditions. And Erica writes, most people in my social circle would be willing to pay more for their food to enable fairer conditions. It's difficult to know when you're not buying organic produce that workers may have been exposed to pesticides. What kind of legislation can we work on to protect workers? I think most people will pay more if they know it's giving dignity to the laborers. Erica, you want to take that?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, something that I've been kind of sharing already, and Robert lifted this up, is what we've done extensive research on what a living wage would look like for farm workers. We published Harvesting Dignity here with our partner coalition with MICOP here in the Central Coast, and it really discloses that if we were to raise a living wage for farm workers, the price for consumers wouldn't be affected as drastically as some people like to claim that it would be. I mean, we've seen the increase of wages for fast food workers, for healthcare workers, and it's something that every worker deserves, right? A living wage and safe working conditions. I think one of the things that we've been seeing is how the agriculture industry is actively lobbying so they can legally pay farm workers less and less. We've seen this with the government's permission to pay H-2A workers, which are the modern braceros, as low as $13 an hour now. That's $3 less than the state minimum wage. And I think this is just another example of how farm worker labor is devalued and why so many families are forced to pull their children into dangerous, exhausting work just to cover basic necessities. And, you know, I think now the time is to actually do something. The agriculture industry can't continue to get away with exploiting their workers. And regulations do exist, but enforcement doesn't. And when that happens, the message is clear that profit is prioritized over people. But right now, we have the chance to change that.
Let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Leslie writes, child workers can also be exposed to sexual abuse or assault, as female farm workers are. We as consumers must speak up at the county and state level for the protection and empowerment of those working in the fields. Robert, did you come across any reports of this in your reporting?
Yes, I did. From a couple of young teens, you know, who currently work in the fields. That wasn't the thrust of this article, which focused more on working conditions, but that is something that I do want to come back and examine. And so that's a reality, unfortunately, as it is in many industries.
And we have had reporters here at KQED who have also covered the issues as well. Pamela writes, I thought there were laws to protect children. I'm disappointed by this, on top of the Trump administration destroying children's education and health care and threatening them with deportation. And Kim writes, the operative word here is child, and no child under the age of 18 should be working in the farm industry. This is exploitation. Robert, you have, you know, been concerned, as, I mean, I guess for lack of a better word, right? That the state, you said that you hope the state doesn't ban child presence in the field altogether. Why? Why not?
I don't recall saying that. What I think I said is that if young people are going to be working.
No, you told the star producer, Caroline, I'm sorry, in her notes, but maybe.
Yeah, well, what I think I meant to say is that if young people are going to be working in the fields, you know, laws need to be enforced. And right now, they can be 12 years old, as we all know. And until that changes, that's the reality out there. And if that's the case, which it is, then, you know, they need to be protected. And so that should be happening.
This listener wants to know how it was possible that you were able to work during the school year, because there are laws around school versus work. But Erica, in your case, you did not work, right, during the classroom hours?
No, I would work only in the summer. So during summer vacations when school is out of session, or even during our spring breaks. But I know that there were other children that were working in the same crew as I was that were working throughout the school year, and they would come back on the weekends to continue to work all year round.
And Noelle on Discord wants to know, did Robert originally intend to cover the kids of adult farm workers? How did you come to this, Robert, in terms of a story to investigate?
Well, that's an interesting question. And no, I did not initially set out to look at young people who work in the fields. I was interested in other issues such as housing. And by that, I mean the lack of affordable housing, substandard housing. And so I just started talking to people who were involved with agriculture. And eventually, you know, I learned about child laborers, and that sounded interesting. So I started researching that to see what had been written nationally and in California. And then ultimately, I sort of focused on that topic, and I honed it to California. And I knew it was something that I really wanted to write about, and I thought it was something that could have a an impact if I was able to pull it off. And so it really was a series of steps, just talking to people and learning more about the industry. And so it was just sort of a, you know, a series of just talking to one person after another that got me there.
And what impact are you hoping your reporting will have?
Well, I hope it improves working conditions for families and children in the fields. And that ultimately the things that we heard these young people describe, you know, don't happen.
Susan writes, I'm a former state director of migrant education for a state far smaller than California. The Migrant Education Program is a federally funded program under the Title I legislation. It provides support in school as these kids move from one location to another. Are you familiar with this for kids who are migrants, Erica?
Yeah, I was actually part of the program myself, and it was a really helpful program in the sense that it definitely provided that additional support as I transferred through different schools, as my family moved around California for seasonal work. But, you know, reflecting on it now, you know, as the age I am now, I'm really appreciative of how that program has supported me, but also acknowledging how a lot of things are created to continue to sustain this system for families to continue traveling from one place to another just to be able to provide for their families. And I remember when my parents would migrate, it was a lot of the times because the work they were doing was seasonal and they needed to continue to follow the work. It was really difficult for myself and my siblings to be able to adjust to make sure we weren't falling behind school. But this is a condition that continues to exist. And I think, you know, if families were just paid, you know, well and dignified wages, they wouldn't feel the responsibility to migrate and putting their, you know, having children continue to suffer through that, not only in working themselves, but also trying to adjust and keeping up with the pace of their schooling.
We're coming up on the end of the hour, but does your family still work in ag?
Right now, yes. I have my mother that works there and a lot of other family relatives that work in agriculture. My younger sister, actually, she is 15 now, and she has worked in the past summers with my mother.
How's she doing?
She's doing really well, but I think it's also something that continues to make me feel sad in the sense that, you know, my immediate family members are still experiencing these harsh conditions, but I definitely feel it vital in the role that I am now and the position I am now to continue to advocate for all farm worker families and make sure that, you know, we're pushing decision makers and policymakers to really take a strong stance and a strong initiative to address this generational issue.
Erica Diaz-Cervantes, a former underage farm worker, now senior policy advocate at Central Coast Alliance United for a Sustainable Economy. Robert J. Lopez, independent journalist and fellow at the McGraw Center for Business Journalism. You can find his reporting in the LA Times, including California's child farm workers, exhausted, underpaid, and toiling in toxic fields. My thanks to both of you for coming on to share what you have experienced and investigated. My thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments, and to Caroline Smith for producing today's segment. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the Generosity Foundation and the members of KQED.
Up next, we take you back to KQED traffic with Elaine Leong. Details about a crash in Palo Alto now.
Dave, we're going to go northbound 101 past San Antonio. It's a spin out with the car into the guardrail there. We do have traffic slow from Shoreline Boulevard. Better news on the span of the Bay Bridge. We had a car that blew its tire. That's been pulled off safely out of lanes there to the right-hand side. We are seeing some heavy traffic, though, from the island as you head into the city. It will loosen up once you're beyond the central freeway merge. And if you're northbound on 101, that will slow approaching and passing Cesar Chavez. Mass Transit, by the way, on time. Elaine Leung for KQED.
Traffic and transit support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at Kia.